U.S. State Department messages concerning the CIA have been made public by the Iranians in the American embassy. These documents have been displayed on Iranian television and also given to the international press, including the United States. Have you seen any on television? Or in the press anywhere? Well, tonight we'll have a show and tell on Alternative Views News Magazine. We focus tonight on two of the most serious situations in the world today, Iran and Afghanistan. We have two people who have been intimately involved in the situation in Iran. Lisa Radcliffe, an American, has just come back from an extensive trip to Iran and has some of those documents we were talking about a while ago. And also Kazem Allah, a poet, a political dissident who was incarcerated and tortured for a year by the Shah. This interview we have with him is very strong stuff. Well, I won't go. It certainly drained me, and it will give you an idea of what it was like to be an Iranian under the Shah. But first, Afghanistan. Doug, you have some material, do you not?
Well, within the mass media, there have been few sober, rational, and moderate appraisals of the situation. So I was surprised to find that the Wall Street Journal had perhaps one of the more rational accounts that put down, that downplayed the dangers that were posed to the United States and the so-called free world from the Russian invasion in Afghanistan. The Wall Street Journal said straight out in their headlines that new military thrusts by the Russians are doubted, and said in the first sentence that Moscow is unlikely to carry its military adventures much further anytime soon. They stated, both American and European scholars, and stated forthrightly that there was little danger that the Soviet Union would invade targets like Iran, Pakistan, or the Persian Gulf. They pointed out that, for one thing, Moscow may have its hands full in Afghanistan now, and they're not going to have the ability to carry on any more military adventures because they're going to have to put so much of their energy and resources in quelling the rebellions in Afghanistan. Indeed, one of Carter's advisors say, and I quote the Wall Street Journal again, "I think they'll pause and digest Afghanistan. The Soviets want to expand, but probably without paying big costs." Moreover, another one of the top analysts at the Institute of International Studies in Geneva added, again quoted in the Wall Street Journal, "I don't think this is the beginning of a great Soviet expansion using military power. They're not risk takers in international relations. They will watch all opportunities and take advantage of whatever opportunity they can." Frank, you have some more information in an article from The Nation that also raises questions whether there is a major threat to American interest there, or anything out of the ordinary.
Right. The writer says that the situation in Afghanistan is really not all that significant. He says it is significant in the sense that it's an occasion for some of the most undiluted irresponsibility and crass demagoguery on the part of the U.S. administration for a long, long time. They said that the Soviets have had friendly relations with Afghanistan, close relationships, for many, many years. And particularly since 1955, Afghanistan has been militarily dependent on the USSR. And there were Soviet-backed regimes before, and the one which was just deposed was completely intolerable. The people didn't support it. And so the Soviets came in to restore order. And they said this was the case, not a long, gradual strategic advance all over the rest of the globe, as we're being told all the time. They are not interested in going to the Persian Gulf or gobbling up Iran for a lot of reasons, one of which is the Soviets are the number one producers of oil in the world. They don't need all that extra down there right now, at least.
I have another point on this. There has been a lot of concern that the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan would lead to an invasion of Iran, since there's a border between Iran and Afghanistan. What these reports omit, and this is pointed out in the Wall Street Journal, is that there's the Himalaya Mountains between Afghanistan and Iran, that it would be very difficult for the Soviet Union to go across these mountains to invade Iran. Moreover, the Soviets already have a border with Iran on the north, which is a flat area that with good roads that they could easily, they could have at any time, gone down and gobbled up the oil in the Persian Gulf in the south of Iran, if this was their intention.
There's another aspect of this which is reported by the right-wing newspaper, The Spotlight, and that is the rather ironic fact that the trucks which the Soviets used to move into Iran were made in the Kama River plant, which on the face of it isn't much. However, the Kama River plant was built with the money and the technical assistance of the United States multinational corporations and the consortium of banks. The writer also points out that the reason you don't see the financial sanctions of the type to take retaliation against Iran being used against the Soviet Union is that the two economies are very much intertwined, and to do that would have a severe repercussions on the Western economy as well as in the Soviet Union. He says that the flow of credit from the West to the Eastern European states and the Soviet Union is up to $65 billion now. So if they monkeyed with that, there would be default on a massive scale and be quite significant, create quite significant problems for particularly the banking community.
Let me just conclude this with a frightening quote from the Village Voice to show what's at stake. They cite that nuclear war has become more likely now than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. They also point out something that a few weeks ago there was a computer error that created a 6-minute failsafe alert, that a computer indicated that the bombs were on its way and we were in the failsafe situation, so that the defense establishment was steeled for the final nuclear holocaust.
It's frightening. Speaking of frightening, let's find out what's been happening in Iran. How long were you in Iran?
I was there for a little over 3 weeks.
And where all did you go?
We traveled mainly around Tehran, the city of Tehran. I was there in 1978 and traveled throughout Iran, but for this trip we were mainly in Tehran.
Do you speak Farsi?
I took about a year of Persian at UC Berkeley. I speak sort of passable dinner table Persian.
So that you're pretty familiar with Iran then. Mm-hmm. You're just not somebody who dropped in over there and came back and suddenly is an instant expert.
No.
On it. Well, and so now you're traveling around and telling people what you got and mm-hmm. having a show and tell program. You've got some documents here.
Yes.
Why don't you show us what they have? You got these from the students at the
Embassy in Tehran, the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. These are documents that were released by the students at the embassy, and they were released to the media, and yet they've been suppressed. I don't think that people have really gotten a chance to read through these because they're very incriminating. This one, this whole group of documents here, they're very interesting. They're a series of things for cover considerations, this one here. This man, Paul Timmermans, apparently his cover is a commercial business representative, and he was born in Belgium.
Was he with the CIA?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, they're discussing how he should, this is his background information that mm-hmm. he should be aware of and what have you.
This is not unusual, though, or really not surprising that there are CIA people over there. There are CIA people and intelligence people in every embassy.
Oh, no, I don't think it's a big surprise. See, the CIA in Iran was not just reading newspapers or doing this and that. They were actually engaging in in sabotage, engaging in, during the time of the Shah, that they would follow Iranian dissidents. They would turn them in, and these people, you know, were tortured to death or put in prison and what have you. When I talked to the students at the embassy, they had found loads and loads of counterfeit Iranian money that was going to be used to flood the Iranian economy and wreck it. They found electronic spy equipment, all of the things that we are sure exist inside the embassy, but, you know, are used against the Iranian people. I think another one of the significant things that the U.S. Embassy was used for is that it was a central organizing place for subversion and counter-revolution in Iran. And then by that I mean that certain embassy officers, their job was to go out to different forces before the revolution, after, during the revolution, and after revolution that were loyal to the Shah, and to organize them around the U.S.'s plans for a coup.
Well, hey, let's get to our back to some more goodies here. What you got?
Well, this one here was written in September 30th, 1979, and it basically is a discussion on bringing the Shah, its subject, Shah of Iran, and it's a discussion between the State Department. It's emanating from the embassy to the State Department. And it says, this, I think this is a very interesting paragraph. Paragraph 4 says, given the kind of atmosphere and the kind of public posturing about the Shah by those who control or influence public opinion here, I doubt that the Shah being ill would have any ameliorating effect on the degree of reaction here. It would presumably make our own position more defensible if we were seen to admit him under demonstrably humanitarian considerations.
So it was being arranged way ahead of
time. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and in fact, you know, this is, again, this whole question of the Shah's illness, which was the cover for bringing him into the United States, is really, to a large degree, blows that away in the sense that it's clear that what they were trying to figure out is what kind of face to put on his being brought here. This one here is particularly interesting because it is a communique between Sullivan and the head of the Bank of Omran.
Sullivan now is who, I forget?
Sullivan was the ambassador to Iran during the time of the Shah. And he was there until the completion, to a certain degree, the completion of that portion of the revolution in which the Shah was forced to flee the country. The Bank of Omran is the Shah's personal bank. Okay, and what Sullivan is instructing this man to do is to go into that, to the Bank of Omran, which is now being controlled by young, enthusiastic, sort of revolutionary-minded Iranians, and sort of go in there and wreak havoc within this bank.
Right.
A lot of places I go, people say, are these really real? And I feel like saying, well, what do you think I did? I went home and got 7 different typewriters and fabricated these documents. What purpose would that serve?
Yeah.
And that they're always referred to in the sort of the normal, the big press or what have you,
yeah,
as the alleged documents, these so-called unauthenticated documents.
I have to share you with other media here in Austin, and you have to go, but I hope
you... Thank you very much for having me.
Come back again. This is really great.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Lisa Radcliffe. So frequently in the media or in discussions or in the press, we see things like, well, so-and-so was a prisoner of the Shah. What was that really like? You know, it's one thing to kind of, well, he was a prisoner, he was in jail. What was it really like? What does it do to a person? And what is the Iranian situation like now and then? It's difficult for us to get good information in the United States because it's filtered through the regular establishment media mainly. But now we don't need that filtering because we have Kazem Ala, who is a poet, writer, former political prisoner of the Shah, now living in Houston. And we'll discuss all these subjects with him. And with us is Christy Birdfeather, who's with CRIME, nothing illegal, it just means the Coalition Against Racism and Intervention in the Middle East. They are very active on the campus of the university. Kazem, in a way, I hesitate to ask you some of these questions because I know it must be very painful for you. But can we go back a few years ago? What was it like in Iran when the Shah was there?
I began to be active in politics when I was in the 10th grade of high school. And we used to have this kind of secret meetings in our houses, talking politics and different subjects. Then we began to take it to the high school, like we used to have this wall newspaper, you know, wallpaper, and I used to put my poetry on it. So they began to suppress it, and they expelled me from, you know, high school for that reason.
The school was suppressing it?
Yes, okay. But it was mainly because, you know, Sabak was controlling everything. There were these supervision committees in every school.
Supervision committees of Sabak, the secret police?
In every school.
In every school.
I mean, not only schools, in factories, I mean, in everywhere, offices, you know, they had these supervision committees that they were just having files on everybody's activity. And they several times warned me that to not do that. One time they got me when I was entering the, you know, school just before we had an exam.
In high school?
In high school, and they told me that if you go ahead, we'll arrest you and we'll do that and this to you, and they were just intimidating me.
And then when you got to college, you continued your political activity?
Yes, when I entered the college, just 3 months after I entered the college, I got arrested.
What was the pretext they gave then?
We had this mountain climbing organization in university, kind of a sport organization, which was, by the way, illegal, because every kind of, you know, organization were illegal, especially in universities. And we had these several students on a team going to mountain climbing near Tehran, and they were lost, and we knew they were lost, and we called the, you know, police stations to get their help, to send some helicopters and get them. It was in winter, and excuse me, they didn't give us any damn help. And then we sent another team, and we found their dead bodies. They were frozen.
You sent a team of students?
Yes, team of students. And when we brought their bodies, I mean, everybody was outraged, because they could have sent helicopter and saved their lives. They didn't do that. And we had this funeral at a mosque called Ark Mosque. And the mosque was in the center of Tehran near the bazaar. And lots of students, several thousand, I can say, from all universities came to that funeral. And the army and the police were surrounding us, and they attacked us. They killed one student and arrested about 300 persons.
Including you?
Including me. And it was about Christmas time, and, you know, Tehran was very cold. They stripped us. They beat the hell out of us.
They put beat you with what?
Flag. With whips.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yes, with cable, actually. They were
cable.
This thick, I mean, probably 3/4 of inch thick. And they shaved our, you know, hair and just make us look very ugly, and they beat the hell out of us.
All over your body?
All over our body. Well, it was funny. Every of these Sabak people, torturers, would come and just to have fun. It was, they were enjoying it, just to punch or to get somebody's ear and pull and do all, you know, I mean, they were just sadists, you know, they loved it. And there was this guy called Hosseini who used to just love torturing. He was saying, you know, they call me Hosseini, and have you heard my name? I kill people under the torture. I burn them. So just tell me the truth. Do not, you know, play around with me. And, you know, just that kind of thing. And when you said, well, I don't have nothing to say. I don't know why you have arrested me. Okay. And they would put you on this bed or, you know, chair, special chair, beat the hell out of you, or make you naked and, you know, do all kinds of crazy things. But that first time they couldn't keep us more than 2 months, because first of all it was mass arrest, and all the universities went on strike. I mean, then the bazaar in Tehran went on strike to our support, and then there were these all kinds of solidarity messages from factories, and so they really got harassed. They really were scared to keep us. So after 2 months, They freed most of us. They kept several, but they freed most of us. They had, you know, some kind of, you know, eyes on us. Even they left, you know, they.
I mean, after they released you, they still
yes.
followed you and kept track of what you were doing.
Yes, I believe so, because the second time that I got arrested, about 11 months after I was freed, they knew pretty, I mean, not all of I did, but they knew a lot where I went. Even they knew sometimes that what kind of movies I watched, you know.
Did they have surveillance on your friends also?
I believe so, because they arrested several of my friends too.
So after you got out, after what, 2 months the first time?
2 months,
then you
61
went back
days.
To the university?
They didn't want to accept us.
At the university?
At the university. And, but, the, you know, our fellow students went on strike, so they accepted us under this condition that any time we hear something against the government, we have to report it to SAVAK, and if they catch us on something, then we hereby admit that they can do whatever they want to do.
So that was the condition in which they accepted you back into school. You had to become a SAVAK informer.
Well, we didn't sign that. Uh-huh. We didn't sign that. Nobody signed that. We stayed away from university for about 2 or 3 weeks. So they softened their position because the university was still on strike and our fellow students wanted us in. So they just got this piece of paper that I promised to not get involved in politics and sign it. So then they wanted our parents to co-sign it.
Oh.
So, I mean, and then parents came and co-signed it and then they let us in. That was it. But we were on surveillance. We had several times, we were several times raided on, you know, campus badly. I mean, really badly. People got killed.
Raided by SAVAK and the army?
And the army. When they raided the campus, they could get anybody, no matter he or she was involved in demonstration or not. They would just get anybody that they get.
They just make these raids and,
raids and then just beat them and arrest them. Yes, and several of our students, you know, got refuge on the roofs. The fifth floor, the sixth floor, they threw them away, just threw them like garbage
down.
And many people got killed that way. Many people had broken legs or arms or, you know, just to say that any time you protest something, that's, the response you get. So just shut up. And they did several times that, and several times they raided the dormitories and but I didn't get arrested. I mean, we escaped.
So you managed to not get arrested for, what, another
11 months.
11 months. And what was the reason you were arrested and imprisoned the second time?
The second time, we had these fellow students getting killed on the dormitory. And we just overnight, we decided to make a funeral for him. And I went door by door with several other students and raised money and got people's, you know, support and asked them to come and participate. And he was, you know, a native of Isfahan. We had to go to that city. We moved overnight. We went to that city and with the help of the Isfahan University students, we organized a funeral. Funeral was, you know, forbidden. Couldn't have funeral and getting the body into the cemetery. It was against the law. It was public gathering against the law.
Even the funeral was considered a public gathering and
yes.
it was against the law.
Yes. You couldn't, you know, walk in the streets, you know, with, you know, people more than 5 or 10. So the police was everywhere to prevent us, but we really organized that. We got lots of support and people just were pissed off this kind of, you know, operation. They joined us. I mean, the passerbys that they didn't know who was Kid, and we were saying, you know,
everybody joined the funeral
procession. Yes, and it suddenly grew. I mean, they couldn't attack it, and it was just great. I mean, then we began to say slogans against the Shah. I mean, we turned it to an anti-Shah demonstration. And when we went to cemetery, we read some statements, just talking to people, and when we went back for about a week, and they began to arrest everybody who was suspicious in, you know, being involved or organizing this funeral, and they got me. But the main, they first did not ask about that funeral. They were just saying, okay, now what kind of affiliation do you have with this guerrilla movement? They were just torturing me for those reasons. You are a poet and you are radical. Why did you read your poetry for your, you know, friends? You were you instigating riots? I mean, just this kind of questions.
So they were trying to get you to confess to various types of activity which you may or may not even have been involved in.
That's true. And the way they began to, as they put it themselves, to work on me was and is something that I can never forget. I mean, it's just like a continuous nightmare. First, they made me complete naked and they searched everywhere. I mean, just humiliating, you know, just playing with your body and not only searching. And then they threw me to this solitary and they said, okay, now you have 24 hours to say everything yourself. Otherwise, then we'll work on you. We know how to make you confess. And it was not just 24 hours, it was just being in the center of these torture chambers, hearing all of these cries and screams coming everywhere. I mean, I couldn't sleep for a minute that 24 hours because of this. I mean, you are in the solitary and this guy is screaming, kill me, don't do that, just kill me. And this, I mean, screams all over, it's, it filled your ears. And once in a while, this guard coming and looking through that hole to you and or suddenly opening the door, what you're doing. And this kind of, you know, just harassing you. Then the next day, in the morning, they took me to this room that was filled with blood, you know, very low ceiling, and there was this bed filled with blood and blood all over, I mean, scabs, you know, I mean, this dried blood everywhere, and this smelled dirty, filthy. And they fastened me, my hands and my legs, to the, you know, to that bed, half naked. And then this torturer that first came and introduced himself, his name was Karimi, I believe. It was his nickname, it wasn't his real name. Came and said, you know, I am Karimi, and I have killed lots of people who resisted to confess. Now, if you be a good boy, you just say whatever you did. We know everything about you. You just want to hear it from your own mouth. And but if you are a bad boy, then I can't promise that you get away alive from here. So I said, well, I don't know what you are talking about. I never did a bad thing or illegal thing. So they called this boy. He was a young, probably 18, 19 years old soldier. And they gave him cable. There were several cables with different, you know, width. And he was just playing with me. Okay, do you want this thick or this cable or that cable? And they gave one of them to that and said, okay, whip him. They whip so bad. They whip me about 100 flags and I get unconscious. Then they poured water on me. And especially when they poured water on my legs, which were bleeding and The blood was springing all over the ceiling and everywhere. It really was painful. Cold blood, you know, cold water on the wounds, and then they kicked me and forced me to walk, jump on my legs. And then they repeated that. I didn't say anything, and this continued for the whole day until evening.
They just continued beating they you or beating doing other things?
They did other things, like he left the room, this carry me guy, and told the soldier, okay, try to get something out of his mouth, I'll be back. And when carry me left the room and, you know, closed the door, the soldier was just like finding kind of bonanza, just, you know, was getting my testicles and just putting, you know, his hands on my mouth and just opening my mouth. And I mean, just like animal. I couldn't believe that, you know, I mean there is a man, a human being, you know. It was just like animal, just, and he tore my bodies with his nails, and it was then
it's difficult for you to talk about it. It's a horrible experience. You don't have to if you don't want to, if you really want to.
I have a duty to say these things for American people to know what was life under the Shah. So anyway, after about half an hour, I was so badly screaming that this carry me came and just slapped in the face. That soldier said, we have not taken any word out of his mouth. We want him alive. We don't want to kill him now. He was really killing me. And they gave me a break for about 2 hours. And then they again began, started again weeping, and like they did something with my fingers that I was thinking that they're breaking it. I don't know how they did it, but I mean, the pain was scratching all over my bones. It was awful. And then they couldn't get any word, and I was bleeding all over. My nose was bleeding, my mouth was bleeding, blood was all over my body. And so they thought that's enough for that day. Then they asked me to walk to my solitary. I couldn't walk, so I sat, and somebody cut my calf and pulled me all the way.
I'm sorry.
To the solitary. And then they began this. I mean, they didn't stop torturing, just taking me to solitary. They didn't let me sleep for 5 continuous days and nights. Anytime I kind of fell to sleep, somebody came and slapped me very bad on the face, so I came back. Then this continued. The next day, they again took me to the chamber, and this time they handcuffed me this way, and there was this hook that they hooked me to that, and they could raise it so I could be kind of hanged with my hands, and the pain all over. And they did it several times. Then they threatened me with raping me.
Raping you?
They threatened. They didn't rape, but they threatened.
Oh, pretend they were going to?
Yes, they pretend they are going to rape me. They made me naked. And there were these drunk torturers coming in, playing and saying, okay, you want to, you know, have fun with you. And, well, I was so torn that I wouldn't I mean, it wouldn't make any difference for me because I was thinking that I'm going to die in an hour or so. I was thinking that. So I didn't react it that, oh, so you are going to do such a terrible thing to me. I just looked at them. So they saw no reaction, no. It was probably just kind of saying, okay.
You're in a state of shock at that minute.
Yeah. So they didn't do it, but then I was, you know, for 47 days in that solitary, very filthy, small solitary. I couldn't go to bathroom. I didn't take a shower for the whole time, and I was stinky. Dried blood was all over my body. I didn't have control over my body. I urinated blood and threw up blood, and there were these horrible moments that in the middle of the night they would sometimes come and wake you up and say, okay, and your execution order has been issued now, come with us, and just blindfold you and take you to a place that you hear, you know, gunshot and gunfire, and sometimes close you to a, you know, bar to something, tree, because you were blindfolded. I couldn't realize what was there.
They would tie you to a tree or
yes.
A post or something,
and then you were ready that you get killed, and you were I was willing to get killed. I mean, I was so much under pressure and pain that death would be, I mean, just a relief. And then they take you back to your solitary. Do nothing, you know, just psychological effect. And I remember that then my wounds on my palms began to infect, and I several times knocked the door and asked them for medical care. They came and beat me instead of giving medical care. Then by that time they couldn't have gotten anything any word against me. They forced some of my friends to confess things against me that I did not admit. And I was fortunate that when they arrested me, everybody knew I was arrested, so my friends went to my house and just emptied. They didn't, you know, left anything for the Savak. The Savak later searched it, but they didn't give anything.
When you were in the cell, what kind of conditions were there? Any rats or bugs or anything like that? Or was it sealed off so at least be protected somewhat?
It was very dirty. I had a very bloody, stinky blanket, and that was the only thing I had. No pillows, nothing. And it was cold. Roaches were everywhere. The horror of these roaches, just walking through my wounds and, you know, eating my body was I can never recover from that.
How were you finally released?
I was in a very bad situation, that solitary, and then they took me. These wounds were really being infected, so they cut the tissues with a scissor and put some bandage, and then took me to public, you know, prison out of solitary. I was there for about 10 months in the public prison, and
did they continue beating you there, or
no?
It was just a regular prison.
No, but they had this regular raids on the prison. We didn't have any pen or paper or something. So anytime they, every week or every other week, they would raid the prison and beat us and look for pen or pencil because they were afraid that somebody who had a visitor might have brought something. But it was impossible to bring a pen in. I had only two visits by my family. They didn't know that I was, I was alive. They were told that I was executed, and they were told that I was, you know, killed differently, not executed. I mean, they were saying all these kinds of lies to my family, and several times my family came and asked to visit me. They beat them. And
they beat your parents. They
beat
when
them
they came
to visit me, and just harassed them that your son was a gorilla and a terrorist, and he's killed. And now, if you come one more time here, we'll take you to the same place. And this kind of harassment. And after 7 months, I had a visit. And but for one thing, they were crying when they saw me, but it was just something for them that they saw me alive. I couldn't walk, you know, for 1 year, and I couldn't really walk and run and like a normal person, you know. These bones still, you know, my palms are still kind of strange. They are not smooth. You know, if you examine them, they are like small heels all over it because they cut the tissues and healed very badly. Then after 11 months, I got a trial, which was pretty funny.
A trial?
In military court, without representation, and I mean, that was just a mockery of trial. The guy that was supposed to defend me was a major, a colonel in the army, and he came and told other judges who were also military officers and told them it was a secret tribunal, and he told them, well, I believe that this boy is guilty. I'm ashamed to represent him. We feed them, we give them education, and now they protest. I mean, he was worse than the prosecutor. So they convicted me to 2 years in jail. I appealed, and it was by the time that the international pressure was really on the Shah and his regime to release these political prisoners, and there were protests all over the world. So the second time I had this chance to have a civil attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And he decreased the conviction by 1 year. But after 1 year, they didn't release me. They were saying, well, we are not going to release you because you didn't confess.
Did they still beat you during that year, or they just keep you locked up?
No, they didn't beat me. They just keep me locked up. And so after my conviction was over, my sentence was over, for 10 days every day, they took me to the, you know, what we call it basement, just to talk me some way, you know, just telling me, we won't release you unless you sign that you will cooperate with the SAVAK. And it was the same time that several other of my friends were also being released, and they would take us together and, you know, just be nice, you know, see if you, we can release you, we can pay you a good salary, you can be, have a good position after you graduate, and all of these kind of
if
things.
If you cooperated with
if
the
you
SAVAK.
Cooperate. So then we said, no, we, thank you. And they said, well, okay, now we won't let you out, or even if you were out, you won't be accepted in, you know, college again. So we were saying, all of us, that we don't want to go back to that college. We want to find some job, and, you know, just anything they said, we refused. They said, we won't let you in the college. Okay, we are not going back to college anyway. And they said, we won't let you to work anywhere. okay, I said, I'm going to help my father in his job. I'm not worried about finding a job. You cannot tell my father to not give me a job. So then after this 10 days conversation and taking us and back and forth, they forced us to sign this thing that, okay, we release you under this condition that every month you report to police where were you, who were you contacted with, you know, where did you go, and these kind of things. And if you wanted to move from one city to another city, you have to report. We signed that, but we never really, you know, did that. Nobody reported. So that was the reason that after they released us the second time, every other month they used to come and pick us at the gate of the university or somewhere in between the university and the house and just, you know, interrogate for 1 hour or 2 hours. Where were you?
Well, these activities that you were involved in, which were the pretense for getting you arrested, were activities that were happening all over Iran at the time.
Yes.
With hundreds of thousands of people.
Yes. Well, we had hundreds of thousands of political prisoners, and too.
And the number of people who were tortured, imprisoned and tortured under the Shah, also must have reached, from what I've read, hundreds of thousands
yes.
of people.
If you were lucky enough to stay on the cross intersection and not get arrested, not because if you were staying for no reason someplace, they would get suspicious and think that you have a date with a gorilla, or because they were suspicious, their logic was that we are suspicious of anybody unless the opposite is proved. Everybody is guilty unless it's, I mean, the contrary is proved, the opposite is proved. So if you had stayed and, you know, could stay one place, and one day you would see these Sabah cars passing by and just picking up the youth for no reason, or searching them on the wall and taking them. I mean, just those people would disappear. The Shah spent several times more on building prisons than building libraries or schools or from this revenue. And in every major city we had big prisons, camps, really big prisons, thousands of prisoners. And in only Tehran we had three big prisons, four. And in my prison probably we estimated there were about 7,000. So if you just see, in Tehran there were about something like 25,000 prisoners, and they were only the prisoners who were in the prisons. The Savak had this headquarters in every other neighborhood, or, you know, just different headquarters that they had, again, you know, death chambers, and, you know, that many of them were exposed after the revolution. People just found them with dead bodies all over, with torture tools everywhere. So I want to say, if in one city you have 25 or 30,000 prisoners, then we had so many prisons all over the Iran. We had big prisons with thousands of prisons in Mashhad. We had huge prison in Isfahan, which Isfahan was a working class, you know, city, and there were unrest there. So just to show you how big this prison in Isfahan was, the buildings for the personnel of the prison was enough for 1,000 families.
Just for the people who ran the prison themselves was enough for 1,000 families?
You got to see this still there in Isfahan. So you can have, you know, an estimate of the dimension of the prison. And then we had prison in Khash, we had prisons. I mean, probably in 100 cities we had prisons. So just get an estimate. It was awful.
Well, it's no wonder then that the people of Iran mistrust the U.S. government a wee bit.
Well,
because it was the U.S. government all this time. The CIA was supporting and training Savak in the
exactly.
U.S. They were supporting and training the army. And the government was supporting the policies of the Shah right up to the end.
Yes, you never heard anything about Shah, what was Shah doing in Iran. You never heard anything here in mass media here in the United States. They were all supporting him. He was really a puppet for their interests. He was doing good for them. And
the multinational corporations and the multinational banks, the Rockefeller banks, were just making billions of dollars out of Iran.
And for one thing, let me tell you this, that Americans in Iran, we were Iranian citizens, but we had second-class citizenship status comparing to Americans. There were places that there were no Iranians were allowed to go, bars or clubs.
You mean
Americans.
Only Americans could go there?
They had facilities, I mean fascinating facilities. On a time that the housing was a major problem for Iranian people, and families of 15 or 20 were living in one big room in shanty towns covered with this metal plate, and you know, which is very hot in summer and very cold in winter, and people freezing to death in winters. Shah was building beautiful apartments, beautiful villas for Americans. We had 40,000 military advisors, United States military advisors, training secret police. And not only training the secret police and army, but actually helping him to, you know, this finding the anti-Shah fighters' places and gunning them down and torturing them, training them torture techniques. Just a few months ago, one of these torturers was confessing before the international journalists in Tehran, and he said that he got his trainees in the United States with several other torturers. They had this. They were all the way behind the Shah, all the way backed him. And only when things, you know, were so bad that they couldn't hide it, they began to say, to portray what was going on in Iran, but in the way that, well, these fanatics are overthrowing a modernizer.
Right.
These crazy people are overthrowing our. This Shah is so wonderful, and these people are just fanatics, Muslim fanatics, crazy people. And just even when they were giving coverage about what was going on in Iran, they were giving this kind of coverage.
And you find that when you came to the United States, that most of the people agreed with this position, I assume. Most of the people thought the Shah was okay, and that the
most of the people that I saw, they were thinking that or expressing that they can't believe Shah was a bad, because all they have heard is that Shah was a great guy, modernizer. Everybody loved him in the country, and this only few bunch of fanatics and communists hate him. I have had really good conversation with many Americans. For one thing, if they know the truth, they'll come and back us. You had the same thing happening in 2 centuries ago. You had British Empire's domination here. You were oppressed, so that was the cause for the first revolution here. So it is not a crazy act to make a revolution when you want to get rid of a foreign country's domination and control over your lives. You also had your second revolution, the civil war, that broke out because of, you know, struggle for civil rights. And thousands of thousands of people shed their blood, and it wasn't a crazy thing. So now that we are doing the same thing, and we are crazy, and you did that 100 years ago, and it is, we shouldn't have this problem now. We should have get rid of our tyrants and dictators 50 years ago, if it wasn't United States government and other foreign countries' involvement in Iran.
What about the Soviet Union and Iran now? There's a lot of hysteria, war hysteria, Cold War hysteria, anti-Soviet. Imagine a lot of people would wonder what the relationship is with Iran and the Soviet Union. They say, oh, the Soviet Union has troops only 300 miles from the refineries, and the Soviets are going to move into Iran. What do you think about that?
You know, any country who was in the side of the Shah, people hated. Soviet Union's bureaucracy, at the time that Shah was massacring, people were sending messages of congratulations for his birthdays.
The Soviet Union was congratulating the Shah, right?
Yes, so people, I mean, were identified, these bureaucrats, with the Shah, and they hated them. I don't believe that Soviet Union has any intention to intervene in Iran. And even though this the present government of Iran tries to say so, to mobilize the people and say that now we are really in danger, that Soviet Union is just 30 miles from us. But we had also 1400 miles border with Soviet Union for all of our life, and nothing happened. So they are not going to intervene. And I mean, people are not that, scared.
In the Soviet Union, right? The Russians saw what the Iranians did, Iranian people did to the Shah. I'm sure they don't want to tackle that.
Yes, they are not looking for problems.
No. Well, Kazem, I wish we could talk much longer about this. I know we're running out of time, and you have to get back to Houston. I do want to thank you for sharing your experiences. I realize it was very painful for you, and quite frankly, it was painful for Christy and I to be here. I just hope, like you say, that the American people can hear and understand and appreciate what the Iranian people have gone through as a country as individuals, so they can understand the part that the U.S. government and the U.S. corporations have played in Iran. Just understand, that's about all you really want, isn't it?
That's what I want, and I also want to thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Well, thank you.
To say something, thank you very much.